In our conversations program this morning, I welcome into our studio a well-known man from Harmony South, Roger Booth. Now, Roger is well-known in the area, but he's also a noted published author. Now, the reason we've got him in is he spent many years writing the history of New Zealand basketball. Now, nobody's ever attempted to do this, and Roger spent something like 6 years, he'll be telling us, to put this together. 6 years writing a book of 568 pages, and if you've read it, or partly read it, or you're going to read it, you'll find that it's one of those books you read, put down, pick up, read, put down, and that'll last you for about a year, because the information in it is so great. Roger, we welcome you into the program this morning.
Thank you.
Congratulations on getting the book out. It must have been a journey for you and your family.
Well, it was. It was. And you just have to keep going until you can do it. And when you're sort of my age, you get into a routine. You know, you need a rest during the day so you can work at night, which I did. I just did it for years until I got it together.
Sure. So you must have obviously had a great interest in putting this together because you've been in basketball for about as long as you can think, way back in 10 years.
Yes, back to the beginning of the book when it develops in a way, because I actually I began basketball myself when I went to Wellington College as a third former in 1958.
Wow.
And that was the year that modern basketball began in New Zealand. So I was in the first phase of modern basketball. Modern basketball is the jump shot,
yes,
the bucket shot, different ways of dribbling, different ways of passing came in that particular year, 1958. So I was in the first group of people that learned basketball.
And that was put on by an American coach, was he, out here
John
on tour?
John Wooden came to New Zealand. John came and said that the jump shot had been, the year before, and said the jump shot had been introduced in America. He couldn't do it.
Right.
So we had to wait until the Americans had arrived at the YMCAs. And we had some boys at Wellington College. Dennis Toon was the one who I remember the most, who watched the Americans who came to the YM and learnt the game. And we used to watch these guys play and do jump shots and bucket shots. Bucket shots were an interesting one because you say to a modern player, you don't know what a bucket shot is, and they don't even know what it is. But in those days, you either did a left-hand or a right-hand shot. And a bucket shot was when you took two hands and you went up in the air, and with your two hands on the ball, you stayed in the air longer. And that's, of course, what modern players do, but they don't call it a bucket shot.
No. Of course, in those days, the ball went into the basket, but you had to get up way, way back in the old years to get the ball out again, I believe.
You did, yeah, originally.
Yes, because that's what I'm finding out about this book. You've got so much interesting information. I mean, nobody would know that. So basketball, when did it first start? Way back in 1900 and what, 8 or something like that?
Yeah, it started in America. Mm. And in fact, the very, very first basketball in New Zealand was actually played by women, would you believe? And that was actually basketball, not netball.
Yes.
But early on, was introduced by Americans in New Zealand and by New Zealanders going away to do service overseas and meeting the game. And it wasn't until 1947 really that it became a New Zealand sport, introduced basketball association, etc.
Right. We'll talk a bit more about the book in a moment, but talking about yourself, you were quite instrumental. You played in Wellington as a colt in the team there and played at school, and you coached players, coached New Zealand teams.
I went to Wellington College. In Wellington College, we were really the champion team around at the time, and I played in the Wellington Colts team, which was under-20 team. And I was in the team that won the first two nationals for Wellington Colts. Alan Bland was our hero. He was a guy who went to Tech, who was an amazing athlete, played for New Zealand.
Well-known man, wasn't he?
Yeah, very, very, very tall, yes. Amazing ability. He could high jump and hurdle, and he played. And I can remember that we used to have rep practice in the morning at Newtown Stadium for 3 hours. In the afternoon, he went off and played senior rugby. And then at night, we played rep matches, and that's what Alan Bland did. And he got into the New Zealand team aged about 1920 when he was in 1962.
Right.
And he was the only modern basketballer in that team that went to Asia in 1962.
Right. So how successful were we in competitions overseas way back in those days? Did we go overseas much?
No. In 1962, we went to Asia, and we actually had some wins. And that was really tough because it was really hot, and it always is, but it was a hot time of the year as well. And they were playing so many games, yes. And they'd never played international basketball against other teams apart from Australia before.
Right.
So it was pretty tough.
Yeah. Now, of course, you got all those results and the teams and the photos in there, but to find this information, it must have been a devil of a job for you, because I believe a lot of the information was not available for you.
Well, typically, and this has happened in a lot of things, including a lot of sports, the stuff had been thrown away. I mean, someone takes over an association, like a New Zealand association, and goes, what's all this? You know, we don't want this. And it just gets thrown away. So a lot of the cuttings, most of the cuttings, most of the coach and manager reports from tours and stuff had been thrown away. So when I came to writing it and realised that I needed to cover between 1947 and 2020, I wanted to cover all the New Zealand games, men and women, senior games, and I had some of the information, didn't have others. So I had to interview a lot of people, and I did over 100 interviews all over the country. I had to see if any of them had scrapbooks, like Judge McDonald, John McDonald, who became a judge.
He was a judge, wasn't he? Yes.
Yeah, his mother kept a scrapbook. And so those sorts of people, I went through the radio station, newspaper files, looking through those. If something's online, and from 2000 stuff went online, and I discovered that if it's online, it stays online. And if you can find the title, like if New Zealand played Korea at a certain point and a certain time, you put the date up, put New Zealand versus Korea, nothing comes up. New Zealand beats Korea, suddenly comes up, or New Zealand loses, Korea beats New Zealand. So eventually you'll bang into an article in one of the main center papers. And right. From the 2000, that's okay. But before 2000, there was nothing online, and I had to find it other ways. And I just needed to cover everything. So if people bought the book, they would tend to be people associated with New Zealand players to buy it for their family. And I needed to cover all the periods as well as I could. So that's why it became quite big.
But there must have been a lot of these people missing, passed on in their lives. How did you get the information in their era?
I had to trace it back. I had to find the older ones, and sometimes the older people had material more than the recent ones. I mean, recent ones tend to not be too worried about that kind of stuff, don't hold on to it, whereas older ones actually did. But, of course, quite a lot when they go into a home or something, they throw this stuff away.
Throw this stuff away, that's right. The children come along to clean out the house, and that's the end of that. Mm. So this information, though, what you've put in the book is real factual information, isn't it? You've got the details down to a T.
Absolutely. So every game that New Zealand has played, senior game, is covered. I've got the team, and I've got the team score for every game. I haven't got the individual scores for just a few, but almost all of them I've got the leading scores as well, and I've got some commentary on the game. Of course, I wasn't at the game, so I had to borrow that. And most of the newspaper reports didn't have a name to them anyway, so you just have to kind of write in the back the newspapers and things that you've used and cover it that way, and that's how it's covered.
And just coming forward a wee bit for a wee while, secondary school basketball at the moment is very popular, isn't it? In fact, they haven't got enough courts. Mm. So that's developed from way back in your era, no doubt, keeping the basketball going.
Basketball is I think it's taken off because it's a safe game. You don't have collisions. You do have collisions, of course, but you don't have intended collisions like you have in rugby. And when you do that, you get injuries and things like that. So quite a lot of people, and particularly parents, are saying, I'd rather you play basketball than play these other sports where you can actually come out of it later suffering. And you can do that from basketball, of course, yes. as well, because it's hard on your ankles and stuff like that. But I think that's the reason why. And at the moment, I believe basketball's got more coverage in secondary school than any other sport.
Absolutely. And, of course, it's televised these days from America, and that's where the kids love to see that sort of action going. And Stephen Adams is a great man for our basketball here, isn't he? Did you have anything to do with him?
I haven't spoken to him. I spoke to Kenny McFadden.
Right.
I was lucky enough to talk to him when he was recovering from the surgery he had and was really good. And when I said, was there any chance talking to Stephen, and he said, Not really, because he's got paid arrangements about the coverage, and it's very hard to crack into that. It was actually interesting when I talked to him that he said from the earliest time that Stephen was in America, he rang Kenny. Of course, it actually got him to America, got him in a position in a team in America, really through his background. And he said, "Oh, they're wanting to interview me. So what do I do? What do I wear? What do I say?" And Kenny said to him, "Say what you feel, and wear what you like.
Yeah.
What do you normally wear?" And of course, when you see him and you see his hair and you see the way he is and the way he presents himself, I mean, he's more Kiwi than any Kiwi. He's amazing.
Yes.
And he's retained that image, because although he's a strong and very athletic and plays really out on the court, he's really kind.
Yes.
Off it.
He's helped a lot of basketballers here back in school when he comes back home now and again, doesn't he? 7'2", I believe, wasn't he?
Yeah.
About 116 kg. Mm. And he was one of 18 children.
Well, they're not quite sure.
Yeah, right, okay.
His dad had a few partners through the years.
Did. Yeah. Now, the other name that's coming up in the book, and I've noticed it, and I haven't read the full book yet, was Sir Lance Cross. He's now Sir Lance, but he wasn't at the time, but he is Sir Lance Cross. His involvement seemed to be great.
He was actually, he got into the New Zealand Olympic Association through basketball. He was actually nominated by basketball. He was the president of New Zealand Basketball, and he was really my mentor. He put me on the Wellington Basketball Executive when I was still at secondary school. And I organised Wellington Secondary School basketball in my sixth form, my second to last year at school. And that was because Lance found out I was an organising person at Wellington College and put me through. So he kind of mentored me in the early stages. And he was always very, very keen on basketball. He loved covering basketball when he was away. But, of course, he covered all the other sports
right.
as well.
But you being a principal, when you left Wellington, did you introduce basketball to the colleges you went to, or was it already in action?
Well, I went from Wellington College. The first place I went to was Te Araha in the Thames Valley. And when I arrived in the Thames Valley, they were still playing old-fashioned basketball. So I introduced modern basketball to Thames Valley. And they've just had, Te Araha have just had the had a 50 years or 75 years just recently. And I had the privilege of going to talk to them as the missionary for their area,
yes.
Talking about what it was like in the game. Because when I came in there, I could do a jump shot, and no
I was going to say you'd be introducing that to them, wouldn't you? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fair enough too. Now, women in basketball, when did they first come into it? You said earlier on that they were started before the men, did you?
Yeah. So they came on just alongside basketball. They were treated differently for quite a long time, and they didn't have the possibility of international games apart from playing Australia for quite a long time. And of course that's continued really, and the coverage of basketball recently covers women's basketball a lot better, but through the years quite often you'd find the men's game being covered really well and women's quite well. It was really good when the two national competitions were together for the finals, and I think it was a pity when they changed from that, because that was recognising that the men and women were the same as each other and having a championship with the final, but that changed.
Yeah, I found out in your book again, the first New Zealand Women's Association founded in 1945.
Right.
And a lot of people wouldn't know that.
Very early.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Like I found out when I was doing the cricket interview, women's cricket was in 1886. Well, nobody much knew that. In fact, they rang up to find out if that was correct.
Yeah.
You don't mean 1986, they said. I said, no,
wow.
It wasn't. So it just shows you how it goes. What about the New Zealand Referees Association? When was that formed?
That was in a similar. Most of those things were happening in the early 50s. Yeah.
Now, the floors in those days for basketball weren't all that conducive to springs, were they? And they were fairly solid. In fact, some of them were clay, I believe.
Well, yeah. We played in an asphalt floor, would you believe, in Wellington at Newtown.
Wow.
It was really embarrassing because we'd go away playing for Wellington in tournaments all over New Zealand and play on wood, and we'd come home to the capital city and play on asphalt. And I was on the Basketball Association, as I said, from the sixth form at school, and I said, let's get a wooden floor. And everyone said, yeah. So when I became president when I was at university, or chairman of Wellington Basketball, I said to them, we're going to get a wooden floor. And they said, okay, right. And I said, well, what we're going to do is we'll ring every basketballer and we'll have debentures, $10 debentures. Remember debentures that we had back then?
Yes.
And it was only a few thousand, you know, but of course that was a lot of money then to raise. And we did it by $10 debentures. I said to every basketballer, you get a list of players, you ring them up, and you don't say, are you going to buy a debenture? You'll say, how many debentures are you going to buy? Because you get your money back,
yes,
and you get a wooden floor. And that way we paid for the stadium. And it was sprung, which is actually a sprung floor, and there are very few of those in New Zealand even now.
Right.
And when the Globetrotters came, I remember in our time, they wanted to take it away with them because it was such a beautiful floor. Unfortunately, some guy stole a car, and he ended up, when they were chasing him, he ended up, I think that the engine caught on fire, and when he scrambled out of the car, it was right next to the stadium, and it caught fire to the wall of the stadium, and it burnt down. So the wooden floor was gone. The Wellington Archives went with it.
Now, what, Palmerston North, though, they developed a big stadium up there, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, and they were gradually happening through the 60s and 70s around the country, and we were lucky to go away and play in the beginning of quite a lot of those.
Sure. Now, Glenn Denham seems to feature in your book too a lot. How did he help you out here?
Well, Glenn's an amazing guy. I interviewed him when he was in Massey in Auckland, and it would be the most amazing interview I've had. I've done, like, virtually thousands of interviews in my life, but For a guy who captained New Zealand for 15 years, I could ask him about any player in that team and he could tell you where he came from, what he did on the court, what he didn't do on the court, what sort of family he came from, where he is now, about anyone. Now, that's amazing.
Yes.
Because most people can't remember who was in the team last year. Glenn Denham could tell you about that. And I just found him an amazing person to talk to. And because I'd been at Aotea College, because I was deputy principal at Aotea College, and it was a multicultural college, when he was appointed at Massey, it was a very similar situation. He had to transform Massey High School in Auckland. So when I talked to him, we had school talk about the two schools we've been at,
yes,
and basketball talk. So it was fascinating. And he wrote the introduction, the preface for my book, and wrote some nice things about me, which was very kind.
He did.
And now, of course, he's principal at Wellington College.
Yes,
which is totally different from Massey.
Yes. I see the name Greg Fontaine came up too somewhere. You're thanking him. He was out here at Paraparaumi College years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So what was his involvement, just in getting this book together, or was he responsible for the occasion to launch the book?
That sort of thing. Yeah. Angelo Robinson is another one who I've known for a long time, and I'm actually just working with Angelo and Frank Mulvihill to do something to recognise Kenny McFadden, because, you know, we can't forget that guy, because he was so important to show. He showed us how you play the game.
Yes.
We came to the games to watch that guy win games for the Saints in Wellington. He went on for years driving people and encouraging people.
Does he feature in the book here? I haven't got to that point yet.
Yes, yeah. Of course, it's near the back with Stephen Adams.
There's a fair bit of book to read, that's for sure, 586 pages of it.
Yeah.
The game of basketball, as I say, is becoming very popular now. How successful were we back in those days, and how successful are we today? Are we going to the Olympic standard or not?
Well, when we came fourth in the World Championships, that's the best that we've ever done.
Yes.
And I think we went through a peak at that period of time. I mean, people are expecting kind of Stephen Adams to come back and play for New Zealand. And I think, again, talking to Kenny about the situation with Stephen, he's not. I mean, the media has suggested that Stephen's not playing for New Zealand because when he was a New Zealand junior, they didn't pay for him to play for the New Zealand team and he couldn't afford it. Well, he was actually already at Scots College and managing okay, and that wasn't the situation at all. But, I mean, he's gone to America and people pay, you know, he's paid for by the teams he plays for. He can't easily go away and play for someone on the other side of the world in a relatively unimportant tournament and then come back injured.
Right. I see we've got a young girl over in America, NBA or whatever they call it over there for women.
Mm.
She's really top of the team list over there, isn't she?
Her mother was a very good player and her sisters are a very good player. There's three of them, yeah.
So that just shows you, it starts from the roots and works through.
Mm.
So are we getting more feeling from the schools that these kids want to play basketball? I know I've got two grandsons who are just mad on basketball.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. They're bouncing the ball all day.
Mm.
And I think that's the way it's got to be. It's a bit like Tiger Woods when he started golf, you know, and his son. Mm. They've got to start at that lower level to go right through.
It's a tricky situation. You can certainly get into playing college basketball, which is what it's really called in America, if a team accepts you to come in and play basketball for a college. And there are colleges that are really, really good colleges and colleges down to fairly ordinary ones. So you can end up in a college and playing college basketball in America and end up kind of going nowhere because that doesn't actually get you recognised or get you into the right places. But if you get into the right situation, sometimes it can work out. One of the people who, of course, did that was Stan Hill, who went to America and he was at the verge of getting into playing in the league in America when he came back to New Zealand, and he realised what he was missing in New Zealand. At the same time, he was given an invitation to play basketball in England, and in the end didn't go back to America and went to England. And he was a case in point where if he'd gone to America and played league, he might have ended up the most outstanding player we've ever had in American basketball, but he didn't. But he was a really interesting story, Stan Hill, because I interviewed Stan, and he's a pub owner in Coromandel. And Stan Hill, being such an amazing player, I obviously needed to talk to him. And people had said to me, good luck with Stan Hill. He doesn't like the media, and he doesn't really like talking to people like that. So, you know, the best
that was
of luck.
Stan, wasn't it? Yeah. He was always like that. You try and speak to him, he didn't tell you too much.
So I rang him and said what I was doing and said, I'd love to come up and have a chat. And he said, right. And I said, well, it'll be okay if I came through and have a talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, well, I'll let you know and I'll come through. Right. And that was the first conversation. So I thought, well, maybe people are right. This is going to be difficult. And I didn't hear anything when I told him I was coming.
Yes.
Got no communication. And I thought, well, I don't want to go all the way to Coromandel and find he's not even there. So I rang and said, did you get my message? Yep. And I said, I'm coming next week. Yep. Okay, see you.
That was it.
I arrived in Coromandel, and of course there's only one street in Coromandel, and there's a pub at the bottom and a pub at the top. I didn't know which one it was, and I thought it'd be the flash one at the bottom, so I went to the bottom one. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, and I tried all the doors, managed to get in one, and I walked in. I was inside the hotel, and someone said, what are you doing in here? And I said, I just came through the door, and they said, it's meant to be locked. And I said, I'm sorry, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm looking for Stan. Stan who? Stan Hill. He's up in the other pub, the top of the road. Oh, okay. So I went up the road, and the top pub hasn't got many businesses around. It's just sitting there, and there was smoke coming out of the chimney. And I thought, oh, someone's got something cooking inside. So I managed to get my way in. And would you believe, Stan Hill Jr., the basketball player, was making bacon and eggs for Stan Hill Jr. and, would you believe, Stan Hill Sr., the All Black, ex-All Black. This was actually only months before he actually died. And it was very interesting because I was introduced to him. And as it happened, when I was in Tierra, I played 2 years senior rugby.
Yes.
So I was able to talk rugby to Stan Hill, the All Black, who I could only remember when I was a kid. Yeah,
break down barriers, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And while Stan Hill Jr. went away to organise the wages for his staff, I spent 40 minutes talking to his dad. So I had 2 to 3 hours with Stan Hill.
Fantastic. Stan Hill was known, was he Tiny Hill? In those days?
Tiny Hill was the dad.
Yes, yeah. We always remember that famous line out with him in it, don't
Absolutely.
We? We won't say the words.
He didn't go to England in 1953 because of the birth of a child. It wasn't actually one of the boys. It was the first child was a girl, and he chose to stay home and not tour England for 3 months
yes.
in 1953. And I remember that because I was only a kid then. Mm. And I never ever imagined I'd ever meet him, but I did.
Well, we could talk for hours, Roger, about the book, but to wrap it all up, you've put the book out. How has the reaction been out there from people who've played basketball and are now reading it? What, have you got response from them?
Well, I have. Frank Mulverhill, who's Wellington and New Zealand basketballer, kind of well known, he reckons that every basketball player, New Zealand player, should get it and buy it for their family. That's what he feels about the book, because it's that kind of book.
Yes.
As you say, it is a sort of book that's a reference book, and you go to your pages. So Frank, you know, straight away went to his pages. But he said he got some books for Peter Pokai and Byron Vaitoe and sent them to him, and Peter's in Australia. Peter was a great player for a number of years. He said he's read it cover to cover, Peter, in Australia, and he vouches for it. It's tricky, and selling a book these days is very hard.
Yes.
But the book's there, and there are books. You've got the books in the radio station here.
Right.
Online, you can get it for $80, $100, but I'm selling them for $60. But I'm quite happy for the first five to be sold here to go towards paying for sport on this radio station.
Fantastic.
So you've got five books there waiting for that.
Oh, lovely. I'll read them all. That's for sure. So, I mean, you had to involve the family, I suppose, in this. Your workshop must have been just paper, was it?
Well, and it still is. I've actually got the files of New Zealand Basketball, yes, really, and I now want to. I'm not going to give them back to New Zealand Basketball, because you know what they did with them two or three times. They'll go to the New Zealand Archives, but I've got to put them in a state where people can go into archives and then find what they want. If they don't go into New Zealand Archives, people can walk out with bits and pieces, and that's where they'll be. But I've got about 60 boxes of stuff.
Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations and thank you very much, because if you hadn't have done this book, History of New Zealand Basketball, we'd be no better off.
It wouldn't have happened.
It wouldn't have happened. That's dead right.
Mm.
And one day somebody will say, oh, remember so-and-so? Hey, we can go to the book now and have a look and read up a dossier about them, most probably.
Mm.
And the teams that you've covered, every era, you've got a team and a
name.
And
I challenge other sports. I know it's happening in softball, for instance, where a book is being written. There needs to be a book like this.
Mm.
And if it's not written now, for a start, if you start researching it, you'll find, like I have done, that the stuff is missing. New Zealand Bowls some years ago realised that when all the bowls clubs were closing, they needed to communicate with them and said, give us your stuff. Don't make a decision on it. Don't throw it away. Give it to us.
Sure.
And they've got a place where it's stored, and they sort out what they want to keep and what they want to not keep.
Roger, we thank you very much for coming in this morning and telling us about this lovely book, folks. Don't forget, History of New Zealand Basketball, published by our author here in Raumati Beach, Roger Booth. It's available in bookshops, and it's $60 if you buy one off us here at Coast Access Radio 104.7. And Roger, we'll keep on reading.
Thanks very much.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.